And now, welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all. And we're happy to have with us here this evening James Howard Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. Some have called Kunstler's writings pessimistic, others realistic. You get to decide here this evening as we look at some of the possibilities facing our culture in the next few years as we face oil depletion, climate change, habitat loss, and other converging catastrophes. Welcome to Oasis Forum, James Howard Kunstler.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to begin, if I may, by reading a quote from your book that I think sets up the conversation really nicely. May I?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
On page 148, it may not matter anymore whether global warming is or is not a byproduct of human activity, or if it just represents the dynamic disequilibrium of what we call nature. But it happens to coincide with our imminent descent down the slippery slope of oil and gas depletion, so that all the potential discontinuities of that epical circumstance will be amplified, ramified, reinforced, and torqued by climate change. If global warming is a result of human activity, fossil fuel-based industrialism in particular, then it seems to me the prospects are poor that the human race will be able to do anything about it, because the journey down the oil depletion arc will be much more disorderly than the journey was up. The disruptions and hardships of decelerating industrialism will destabilize governments and societies to the degree that concerted international action, such as the Kyoto Protocols or anything like it, will never be carried out. In the chaotic world of diminishing and contested energy resources, there will simply be a mad scramble to use up whatever fossil fuels people can manage to lay their hands on. The very idea that we possess any control over the process seems to me further evidence of the delusion gripping our late industrial culture, the fatuous certainty that technology will save us from the diminishing returns of technology. So that's actually quite a mouthful.
That's a mouthful.
Yes, it really is. And most of your book is actually kind of a mouthful. I found myself wanting to kind of underline everything. And when I got to that point, I said, you know, you might as well just commit the book to memory, because you really can't underline everything. But I want to just thank you for what I consider to be a very comprehensive book, and one that just doesn't look at it from, you know, one simple angle of oil depletion or resource depletion. Not that that's simple, but that looks at it from sociological angles, historical angles, economic angles, and everything else. So I want to thank you for a very comprehensive book, and ask you to make any comments that you'd like as we get going here in this conversation about the long emergency.
Well, I'm just ready to rip. I don't have any planned preamble.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's sort
you're
of
welcome that. To. You're welcome to just let her rip.
Okay, so let's
ask me whatever you like.
Let's just start with some of the issues. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time trying to establish the oil depletion scenario, because I believe that we've done that with other interviews, and we'll certainly touch on that here today. But I would like to kind of go into some of the other stuff you go into, which is again quite a bit. And let's first talk about some of the myths about, some of the other energy technologies that we're looking towards that might solve the problem, such as solar, coal, wind, and hydrogen. What are these myths that we're talking about? Are these going to be solutions for us?
Well, let's start very generally. There's a great wish among the American public to be rescued from the energy predicament, at least by those who even know about it. And there's a belief that we are going to be rescued by technology, in quotes, and alternate energy. There is a great deal of confusion in the public about the distinction between technology and energy. They are not the same thing. You need energy to run technology. So technology alone is not going to solve this set of problems for us. I think the basic equation is this, that no combination of alternative fuels or systems of running them that we know about is going to allow us to continue running the United States the way we run it now, or even a substantial fraction of it. We will certainly be using alternative fuels and renewables like solar power and wind power and water power, but it's likely that we are going to use them on an extremely local basis, perhaps on the neighborhood or even household basis.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of other issues that are raised by this. One of them is the whole question about whether or not we can even manufacture the components needed to run this kind of equipment, the solar panels, the wind turbines, et cetera.
That's right.
Without an underlying oil-based economy. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that is not settled at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where coal is concerned, I happen to have a friend in town where I live here in upstate New York who's writing a book for Houghton Mifflin about the coal industry. And, he's a pretty experienced journalist, as I am, a middle-aged guy with a lot of experience. And he's been talking to the coal executives for the last couple of years, and he's told me that there is, in fact, they tell him that America has quite a bit less coal than is generally believed. There's a general idea in the public that we have hundreds and hundreds of years of a coal supply
mm-hmm.
In the U.S., and he says that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
He says, furthermore, the quality of the remaining coal that we have is not that great, and so that presents a set of interesting problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Finally, there's the whole nuclear question, which is, to me, boils down to a matter of if we want to keep the lights on after the year 2025, we may have no other choice. But I say that with full recognition of the problems and issues that are raised by nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really the roundup on alternative fuels. I think the bottom line is we're going to have to do a lot more with a lot less.
Right.
And, we are not going to run the interstate highway system and Disney World on solar power
mm-hmm.
or wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
The hydrogen question is a bit more complex. Perhaps Richard Heinberg explained it, did he?
He did to some degree, but it certainly wouldn't be bad to touch on that again.
Well, it seems to be the way the hydrogen economy, in quotes, is being sold to the American people is largely a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
Because hydrogen is the most common element in our neighborhood of the universe.
Right.
But because of its chemical nature, it is always found combined with other elements in chemical compounds, like water, H2O, or methane, which is hydrogen and carbon joined together.
Mm-hmm.
And to separate them, to split them up and free the hydrogen, takes more energy than you get from the hydrogen that you free up. So,
mm-hmm.
The whole thing is like the old Adirondack blanket joke about the guy who sewed, wanted to make his blanket longer, so he cut 12 inches from the top and sewed it onto the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
There are additional problems with hydrogen involving its chemical nature, which make it very, very difficult to store and make it difficult to transport through pipes. It's very corrosive. It tends to eat through the seals.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a light element, it's the lightest element on the periodic table, that it takes up a lot of space.
Right.
And so you can't get that much of it into a contained space, even under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
They estimate that a 40-ton truck of the type that we use to carry gasoline around in refill the stations,
mm-hmm.
that a comparable truck would only be able to carry about 800 kilograms of hydrogen, which ain't much.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, it's so little that it might make the trip itself not worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So hydrogen is fraught with all sorts of problems, and I think the bottom line on that is it ain't going to happen. We can certainly manufacture hydrogen. We've demonstrated that. But can we do it on the scale to run all the automobile and truck fleet of America?
Mm-hmm.
Forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't going to happen. So there you have alternate fuel.
And then we have Canadian companies looking at the tar sands and oil shale there, and what have you to say about the potential for that?
Well, there are a lot of delusions that are about that. One of them is that, you know, people think there are trillions, the equivalent of trillions of barrels of oil out there in the tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true at all. At the very best, there's the equivalent of, you know, another Iraq out there in the tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're faced with the additional cost because tar is not oil. You know, you have to basically mine it before you refine it and you have to liquefy it using a tremendous amount of energy in order to melt it.
Mm-hmm.
So that adds another layer of expense to the whole process. You know, there's no question that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to allow us to run Disney World on the interstate highway system? I don't think so.
Right.
You know, it may allow the people in Canada to keep their lights on a bit longer. Another thing you have to figure is this, is that under the NAFTA treaty, Canada is obliged to sell us a certain amount of their stuff, especially their natural gas and some of their oil resources. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the time may come when they decide that ain't such a good idea,
mm-hmm.
that maybe they ought to keep more of it for themselves because mm-hmm. they're going to need it. So
mm-hmm.
I don't think we've seen the end of that argument either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By the way, the Canadians have made contracts with China for some of the energy that's in the tar sand area.
That's one of the things that Richard Heinberg talks about that we actually didn't get to talk about in his interview last week was the coming resource wars. What do you see for countries such as the United States and China who are, on the one hand, interdependent but also competitors and will increasingly become competitors for these scarcer resources?
Well, it's a very interesting situation, isn't it?
Mm.
We are going to be contesting for the remaining oil left in the world. Most of it happens to be in the regions of the Middle East and Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
China can walk into Central Asia. They can extend their influence there very physically if they want in Kazakhstan and some of the former Soviet republics that have some oil. You know, you could imagine that they might walk a little bit further or extend their influence further, and, you know, they may also offer their protection to Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
You know, and essentially make a deal with them, saying, "Well, you know, you've been under the nuclear protection of the United States for 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you try our nuclear protection? It's pretty good too.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you can sell us oil, and you know, you won't have the same cultural and religious problems with us that you have with the Crusader." Christian West.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, who knows, that might happen. Of course, the whole Middle East is sort of in play. Mm-hmm. No one can tell what's going to happen with Saudi Arabia, with
the
Saud family in particular. You know, somebody could walk into Prince Abdullah's bedchamber with a cell phone full of Semtech plastic explosive
mm-hmm.
at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the end of about 20% of our oil imports.
Yeah, quite a bit of the instability in that region, or the stability created by focusing their angst on external forces like Israel and other things going on around the world. And what is the status right now of the royal family, and what is the likelihood that we're going to see more instability there?
Well, we've had about 6 months of relative stability and calm and a lack of atrocity in the news. But the fact of the matter is the Saudi family is in a fairly precarious position. You know, if only from a population standpoint, the population growth in Saudi Arabia is so extreme, and they have such a large number of unemployed young men who have nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And every year the state oil welfare that they distribute to their citizens becomes proportionally smaller
mm-hmm.
per citizen as the population expands. You know, in short, they have a large restive population there,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people who are ticked off and would like to depose the royal family. So we have no idea how long they're going to be, how long they'll survive, or what the regime will be over there.
Mm-hmm. And now there's
it's not something we can feel that confident about.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we're not, which I imagine is one of the reasons why we're in the Middle East in the first place. Of course, now Iran, whose coal and natural gas fields are reportedly operating far from capacity, and who has been making also deals with China, India, Pakistan, Japan, is believed to be the next target of the United States and the conservatives. Again, the rationale is that Iran is developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, which could threaten other countries. What do you see happening there in the short and medium term?
Well, I don't have the same view of the Iraq and the Iran situation that a lot of my friends have. And, mm-hmm. You know, I do consider myself a political progressive liberal Democrat, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't view the Iraq war the way they do. You know, strategically, I think that we have to look at it this way, that, you know, the Iraq war was a desperate attempt by the United States to stabilize that region of the world that most of the oil is left in, two-thirds of the remaining world's oil in the Middle East. We wanted to stabilize that region desperately.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did, in effect, was we opened a police station in Iraq, which was, you know, the most centrally located one and the best candidate for it because they had a leader who was disliked by just about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We also secondarily went to Iraq in order to moderate and influence the behavior of Iran and Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
and to maintain a presence there so that they would not do anything extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that said, we're there. We've been in Iraq for 2 years. The level of violence has remained fairly constant and significant, substantial.
That's right.
And we're having a very hard time with it. It raises a number of questions for Iraq alone. You know, how long can we actually expect to stay there?
Mm.
Does it mean 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 7 years? At what point does the American public become disgusted with the loss of life and the expenditure?
Mm-hmm.
At what point do we exhaust or bankrupt our military from being there? Can we, in fact, moderate the behavior of Iran? Well, that seems to be a project we cannot feel confident about either, because mm-hmm. they seem to be going about doing what they're doing. They have a lot of, you know, they are making deals with clients who are very potent players in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They're making oil deals with China. China may seek to, you know, help protect Iran in some fashion
mm-hmm.
because of their emerging relationship. Of course, they've got a relationship with us, too.
Mm-hmm.
China does.
Mm, right, right.
You know, we have this enormous manufacturing chain relationship with them. They make all our household goods, and we sell them all of our debt.
Right, right.
And, you know, one thing I believe we can say is this. You know, it happens to be my personal belief that all other things being equal, we're probably not going to remain in the Middle East as a military presence forever, right? Not forever.
Mm-hmm.
And if not forever, how long? Well, probably sooner rather than later we'll have to withdraw,
mm-hmm.
you know, meaning sometime in the next several years we're going to have to start thinking about that
mm-hmm.
and maybe even doing it. I have a feeling that sooner or later the United States will have to withdraw into its own corner of the world, mm-hmm. the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I rather imagine that what we're going to see is that the world's going to become a bigger place again in some ways. We're going to be more or less restricted to our half of the world. We will have trouble projecting our power elsewhere. We may lose access to part of or all of that two-thirds of the remaining oil in the world in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
We may just not be able to control that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then we will be in our own hemisphere, and we will not have access to that energy, and we will have to make other arrangements for how we're going to run our country and run our economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether or not we engage in a land war with China, that would seem to not have very good prospects for us.
Mm-hmm. We're outnumbered for one thing.
and
that's their territory,
thing, you know,
right.
13,000 miles yep. over there. Well, they could just walk over.
Yep.
You know, if we have a land war with them in Asia, you know, I don't see that really happening. But I can see, you know, a definite chill in economic relations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may happen anyway. I really think that globalism is going to wither, and that we are going to live increasingly, self-sufficiently, or be thrown back on our own resources, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. So you talk about a lot about the effects of various other things, but before we get to these other converging catastrophes, let's let's draw out in the mind of the listeners or illustrate, what is the relationship of oil to the rest of the economic and agricultural sector? I know this is a huge question, but if you can just give us a sketch for those who might not be fully aware of how, you know, our dependence on oil reaches into every aspect of modern American life.
Well, there may be three areas that we can discuss, you know, succinctly. One is agriculture. Our food production in America is completely dependent on oil and natural gas. And without it, we would have trouble feeding ourselves. Moreover, we will have trouble feeding ourselves, and we will have to reorganize agriculture on a local basis.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no question that we're going to have to grow a lot more of our food closer to home.
Yeah.
We're not going to have the 3,000-mile Caesar salad anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This raises tremendous questions about reallocating land for farming and the social relations that are entailed by farming. Farming in the future will likely have to be much more labor-intensive if
mm-hmm.
we're not using a lot of oil and gas, quote, inputs.
Right.
You know, what will the social relations be between the people who work the land and the people who own the land?
Mm-hmm.
Will there be a lot of resentment and grievance? Will the lives of the workers be miserable? We really don't know the answer to any of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that has implications for stuff that I imagine we'll talk about a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But a second thing, of course, is that, you know, the whole American economy is really based on the creation of the dirty secret of the American economy is that it's mostly based on the creation of ever more suburban sprawl
mm-hmm.
and the accessorizing of it and the furnishing of it and the servicing of it. And that's our economy. And if you subtract suburban sprawl from our economy and all the activities associated with it, there isn't a whole lot left besides hair cutting, fried chicken, and open heart surgery. And I think that's the explanation for why our business and political leaders don't want to touch the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you start going there, and all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about really erasing the American, most of the American economy. So,
mm-hmm.
so no, that's why John Kerry wouldn't talk about it. That's why Al Gore wouldn't go near the, you know, the suburban sprawl issue because
mm-hmm.
he didn't want to upset the home building industry and,
right.
and everything associated with it. So there's that whole problem. That, of course, has implications for finance and for money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the big implications of the peak oil situation is that industrial economies will not grow anymore since oil is the thing, the food that makes them grow.
That's right. Yep.
If they don't grow, then what happens to the financial instruments associated with economic growth, namely stocks, bonds, you know, equities, securities, all those kinds of things, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the implication is that they will not earn any more money, and in fact that they will contract along with the rest of the economy. And
yeah.
so you get all sorts of perversities occurring in the face of that. And I think the markets sort of apprehend that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have the housing bubble, because, you know, at some level, collectively, the markets, the equity markets, recognize that there isn't any more money to be made in stocks and bonds, and the only place for capital to appreciate right now is in the hallucinatory area of home appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a hallucination.
Mm-hmm. How do you mean?
It's not real. It's based on nothing more than the fact that the capital has nowhere else to go,
mm-hmm.
plus the fact that supernaturally low interest rates and cheap credit, loans made to anybody who has a pulse, are allowing the flipping of ever more houses at ever higher prices. So it's clearly an artificial mania,
mm-hmm.
and it clearly has a terminal point that, excuse me, is going to end in tears.
Mm.
So, you know, that's the financial aspect of the peak oil situation.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a third? Well, you know, I think it has to do with this, the fact that, you know, we're not going to be an easy motoring society anymore.
Mm.
the 21st century is going to be much more about staying where you are, not about being in constant motion. And it's not going to be about mobility. It's going to be about being in a place that you have to care about,
right?
And you have to care for. And that is going to change the basis of a lot of how we live in this country. So that was a kind of a long-winded spiel, but there you have it.
No, that's good. That's good. Well, going back to your example of the housing bubble, at some point that's going to bust, I assume. And what do you? What are some likely scenarios as those rates go through the floor, and what do you think are going to happen to all these homeowners with huge mortgages, and what can they do about it, or what can communities do, or what do you predict they might be able to do?
I don't think the communities are going to be able to do anything about it, really. I think we're going to see a natural process and a natural kind of a change that has to occur, a release of tension, so to speak, in the macroeconomic sense. And personally, I think that we're going to see an orgy of default and a fiesta of distress sales of distressed properties that people can't pay their notes on.
Right.
And I rather imagine that the suburban development industry is going to grind to a halt, and that the home building industry, as we've known it, is going to wither and vanish eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll see very little development in the decades ahead. You know, we're really at the end of a very, very manic cycle. And when that's over, we're not going to see a whole lot of, we're going to see mostly contraction.
Let's take that as an entry to talk more about the economic situation in this country, and the point you mentioned in your book. You talk about when our monetary system was decoupled from gold as a backing standard. Can you say what happened from that point onward, and where are we today?
Well, I'm not necessarily a gold bug myself in the sense that I think that gold is the be all and end all of civilization.
Right,
but our idea of value has been decoupled not only from gold, but it has been decoupled from the idea of the productive creation of wealth per se.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea that wealth is a service economy composed of people buffing each other's nails, is a nonsensical thing. We have not been creating wealth with this.
That's right.
In fact, the whole suburban explosion of the last 20 years, which has supposedly resulted in the creation of wealth, in the sense of a lot of McMansions and McHouses and, new buildings and new strip malls and new big box stores and all that stuff, you could just as easily view that as a tremendous liability for the United States for the future, as being an albatross around our neck. I regard suburbia as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, and a place that was characterized by having no future, as soon as it was built.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line of this is probably that we're going to be in for a massive reevaluation of what value is, and that we'll probably be experiencing a substantial period of disorder around those questions. What is a dollar really worth? Well, a dollar may really lose its value very seriously.
Yes.
I don't know if it'll ever come back or what will happen to it, but I think there's going to be a lot of confusion about what has value.
Yes. Well.
Some hard assets will have value, but some will not, I don't know that, Walter Keane paintings or collectible Hummel figurines are going to have a whole lot of value when people are having trouble feeding themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thomas
Kincaid paintings, which people are paying enormous amounts of money for these ridiculous prints.
Right.
It's really hard to say, but I imagine that we are going to return for some time to a very, very hands-on, practical idea of what is valuable. It may involve a lot of barter. And, you know, I imagine that we'll see all kinds of paper circulating, but I don't think it'll be in the form of monopoly money issued by localities. I think it'll be more in the form of promissory notes, bank notes, and things like that. You know, bills, even bills of lading, you know, exactly the kind of things that we saw, you know, probably earlier in the 19th century.
And so you also talk about lots of other types of converging catastrophes. And what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time on those, and then we'll return to what people and communities can do and what's likely to happen in these various domains of living that we've been talking about. Why don't we go next to water scarcity that you bring up in one of your chapters?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be worse in some regions of the country than others. You know, it's going to be a real problem for those places that have been depending on fossil water, which is the water that's in the underground aquifers that's left over from the previous ice age. And we've been pumping that out of the ground to irrigate lands that, you know, we're farming, but we're farming it with fossilized water the same way that we're farming with fossil fuel. That you know, we're talking here about you know, Nebraska, Montana, you know, the western plains. The West is going to have trouble. I think places like Phoenix and Las Vegas, they're already having trouble. Plus, you know, because of climate change, they're dealing with what appears to be a 500-year drought, which means, it doesn't mean a drought that's lasted 500 years. It means a drought of the kind that hasn't been seen for 500 years, a stretch, you know, a stretch of time, a series of years that have been so low in rainfall and snowpack that the river levels that are at historic lows, you know, ever since we began measuring since the European conquest of North America. And that's where the Colorado River system is at right now, and the dams associated with it, and the reservoirs associated with it that serve Las Vegas and, you know, parts of Arizona and California. Well, seven states in all, really. So that's going to be a problem. Internationally, you know, if you look at China, China has ecological problems that make ours pale before theirs, and specifically with water. They've been drawing down their water table in the northern part of the country where most of the grain is produced at the rate of over 10 feet a year.
Wow.
And they have become net grain importers now. They literally can't feed their enormous population. And their grain yields, their crop yields are going down steadily for the last 5 years. So their prospects are poor. And you know, climate change is likely to aggravate many of these problems. And, you know, eventually you'll see a lot of turbulence and people leaving places that are not, that are no longer habitable, that are no longer productive, and it will make for a lot of trouble. You know, one other aspect of the water situation is, and this is, you know, has implications that are somewhat, you know, more positive for the Northeast. We do have a lot of local hydro sites for producing electricity that were decommissioned, you know, after the 1950s and 60s, because the big power companies didn't want to maintain, you know, take care of these small hydro sites. So I know there are a lot around my area. We have quite a few. We have quite a few small rivers and you know big. You know, the Hudson River Valley is up here. The Mohawk River. The Battenkill, you know, the Saranac, and so on. They had a lot of local sites. We're probably going to have to get much more serious about, you know, local electric, hydroelectric power generation in our towns in the Northeast. But that represents an opportunity for us, and we, you know, we should consider ourselves fortunate.
Indeed. Well, part of my concern is, you know, with the rush to, for some people to, you know, think about solar, mostly I think around here, is that first of all it's quite expensive, and second of all it takes care of me, but does it take care of my community? So what you're suggesting is that that may be a community scale solution. Do you see other community scale solutions while we're on that topic as far as energy?
Well, you know, they're very iffy. Wind turbines do work, but not all places are equally windy, and the wind, you know, is not that reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the turbines break a lot. You have to change them out a lot.
Yeah.
That's just a fact of life. I don't know how far we're going to get with that. You know, plus the problem I already mentioned, how far into the future can we keep on manufacturing the components that we need for this if there's no underlying cheap oil economy to support that kind of manufacturing?
That's right. That's right.
We really don't know the answer to those things.
Right.
You know, I think there's a hope on the part of many environmentalists that we don't go hog wild with whatever remaining coal that we have. But frankly, I don't know how Americans are going to heat their houses.
Mm-hmm.
Half the houses in America are heated with natural gas. And as Richard Heinberg might have explained, we have arguably a more immediate problem with natural gas depletion than even with oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned something about winter of 2003, some catastrophe almost happened with natural gas. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, during the winter of 2000, every year there's what's called the summer injection season. And when houses are not being heated, the gas companies all over North America get gas out of the ground, and they put it into storage in certain places in the ground at the heads of the pipeline network.
Mm-hmm.
The natural gas in America runs all around the United States in a pipeline network. It doesn't run around in trucks for the most part.
Right.
A little of it runs around in the form of propane, but most of the natural gas we use is methane, and it runs around through this pipeline network. So when the winter heating season comes, you know, all that stored gas is released and starts moving around. Well, in about March of 2003, we ran very, very low on stored gas from the previous injection season.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressure started to go down in the regional trunk lines of the pipeline network. And that had never, you know, we had never been in the situation before where the pressure had gone so low that furnaces had gone out as a result, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's never really happened on a mass basis. And so the specter was raised that if the gas pressure actually got that low and the furnaces went out all over America, all over a region,
mm-hmm.
let's say the New York, Connecticut metropolitan region,
mm-hmm.
you know, then some of the furnaces would restart automatically because the newer furnaces do that.
Right.
But a certain percentage of them wouldn't. And when the gas pressure came back on, you know, you'd have all this potential for exploding furnaces,
mm-hmm.
you know, with gas being released but no pilot lights on.
Right.
So then that raised the specter of, you know, what is the power company going to do? Are they going to send technicians around to every building in the region to
mm-hmm.
check the furnace?
No.
You know, they'd need thousands and thousands and thousands more employees to do it. So this, we'd had this unprecedented situation that nobody knew how it was going to play out. As it happened, the pressure never got that low that furnaces went out. But believe me, for a while they were very worried about it. And, you know, it could happen again.
I was going to say, have they prepared for that in the future?
Well, it still raises the same problem. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's still going to be X number of furnaces out there that are not going to restart automatically. And, you know, they're not going to have, you know, 50,000 employees
mm-hmm.
to go out and check them. So, you know, it's just another example of us sort of whistling past the graveyard. You know, nothing happened that time. And, you know, we're hoping nothing happens again. But
right. It's
just hope.
Right. Now, you also talk about epidemics. Can you just touch on that for a moment as part of these converging catastrophes?
Well, we know they're out there. We know AIDS is out there, although, you know, our society is not suffering as much as, say, Africa or even parts of Asia now or Russia. We know that there are some of our old disease adversaries are coming back at us with new immunities to the antibiotics that we've developed,
mm-hmm.
tuberculosis and other diseases, staphylococcus. We know that there are exotic diseases that are moving into new regions because of climate change, things like West Nile and dengue fever
mm-hmm.
turning up in North America.
Right.
West Nile, I think, is now in all 48 of the lower 48 states.
Yeah.
In the hardships that we face in the long emergency that is ahead, We're going to be dealing with people with reduced immune systems, compromised immune systems, people who are hungry, people who are cold, people who are old and not being properly cared for.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these diseases are going to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With AIDS, you know, all bets are off because the rate is doubling every, a certain number of years.
I think you said 5.7 in the book.
Yeah, I forget what it is now offhand.
Mm-hmm.
But,
you
know, it's not a whole lot. And, you know, we now have instances of new strains of AIDS turning up in New York City that are resistant to the sophisticated drug cocktails that have been cooked up to combat that disease. And, you know, we really don't know where that's going. Like all diseases, like all viral diseases, you know, AIDS has a big capacity to mutate. And we simply don't know what direction it's going to go in. So it's, you know, it's going to combine with global warming and with the hardships produced by the peak oil situation to, take advantage of human weakness and human frailty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So looking ahead at what communities can do, we've talked a little bit about the need to do relocalization, especially in food production. We talked a little bit about commerce. What about housing?
Well, let's talk about commerce. We actually haven't talked about that because it's going to be a big problem.
Sure.
And, you know, that's just really regular everyday trade,
mm-hmm.
which we have sacrificed to the altar of Walmart. You know, Walmart has systematically destroyed every local commercial economy in America, practically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Walmart and things like it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they happened because, you know, the growth medium of cheap oil and relative world peace for 50 years allowed it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't particularly a conspiracy. But the American public were kind of complicit in throwing away their own local economies, and now they're going to have to reap the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that it's not going to be easy to rebuild local networks of economic interdependency.
Mm-hmm.
They will not spring forth like mushrooms after the rain. A lot of the knowledge for running local businesses and small businesses used to be transmitted through families.
Right, right.
And that transmission of information stopped for more than one generation. So it's going to be hard to retrieve it. We're probably going to have fewer things to buy and fewer manufactured goods in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Shopping is going to kind of fade more into the background of our lives and not you know, we're not going to be living in that blue light special shopping frenzy that we've been enjoying for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And many of the things we've come to take for granted, we don't produce anymore, textiles among them, and you see those things coming back as well of necessity?
Well, I don't know. One thing is that we're not going to replay the 20th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Many of the factories that used to produce these things in the United States were scaled to cheap energy, which was available in 1923 or 1951, you know, when these factories were built and rebuilt and tooled and retooled. And we're not going to relive that episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it remains to be seen how we are going to produce things. We may only be able to do it on a much smaller scale, you know, perhaps a cottage scale.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the human race is ingenious, and I think that we will have things, we will make things that we need, but it may be a much more limited palette than we've, a much more limited menu than we've been accustomed to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I do want to say something to the question you raised a few minutes ago about what we can do locally. Excuse me. And, you know, I think one of the things we really have to do is this. You know, I wrote three previous books about the fiasco of suburban development and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the issues around that, even before I got involved in the energy issues. And, you know, before there was this idea that suburban sprawl was optional, you know, that towns could either do it if they wanted to or do something better, you know, and it didn't really matter. Now it matters a lot, you know. Every continued misallocation of resources that we continue to make, permitting new strip malls, and approving new suburban subdivisions miles away from town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any continued activity of that kind is going to add to the tragedy of what we're moving into.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got to stop. We have got to get serious on the local level,
mm-hmm,
about changing the rules of the game,
mm-hmm,
and changing the way we value our land and changing the way we do development. You know, we have to get serious about reestablishing this clear distinction between what is rural land and what is town land,
mm-hmm,
and what is the place where the rural activities of food production take place, and where are the places where the civic activities take place. You know,
mm-hmm,
one of the great disasters of suburbia was that it erased this distinction. It allowed people to think for half a century that everybody could lead an urban life in the rural setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's a terrible basis for establishing a sustainable economy and a sustainable nation.
Mm-hmm.
And we now have to really reform that and make that distinction clear again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the first things that we have to do at the local level, is really get in there and stop the monkey business at the city council level and the planning board level. You know, it's really, it's not funny anymore. We really have to stop that. We have to do different kind of development,
mm-hmm,
if
mm-hmm
we do any at all.
Yeah, at the top of the interview, actually, before we got on the air, I was talking about some of the things that some communities are doing, and you may know about Yellow Springs, Ohio, taking this seriously as well, and yet it's still really peak oil, and a lot of the things that you're talking about, these converging catastrophes, are still off most people's radar. What do you see as is going to function as the ultimate wake-up call here? At what point do you think the wave will be ascendant for people's listening to really open up?
I don't think that there's going to be an ultimate wake-up call. I think that we will segue directly from sleepwalking into the future,
mm-hmm,
to being very deluded about what our predicament is and being desperate and doing desperate things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we'll see a lot of desperate political action and a lot of political mischief,
mm-hmm,
on the part of people who are bewildered and confused. I don't think there's going to be any wake-up call at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think what you'll see is a lot of disorder and a lot of turbulence in every area of our lives,
mm-hmm,
our economic lives, our political lives,
mm-hmm,
our social lives. You know, people there are going to be a lot more people that have no jobs, and they're going to be very puzzled about why this happened. You know, they'll blame George Bush or whoever is in the White House. They'll blame their local leaders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they will fight desperately to maintain their ability to live in their suburban house because that's where all their wealth has been invested.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that will be a futile battle.
Yeah,
but they will do it nevertheless. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not expecting that there's going to be any kind of great awakening eruption of common sense.
Well, maybe when it gets bad enough, people will wake up to realize that they have to do something different, that what they've been doing status quo is really not that functional.
Well, I think, you know, a very bottom line kind of idea, people will realize at some point that they got to make other arrangements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What those arrangements will be, who knows? You know, the people who find themselves going from, you know, office work to farm work may be very resentful, and they may want to seize the property of those who have it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's not. There have been revolutions before in this world.
That, right.
It wouldn't be the first time.
That's right.
And they do tend to happen during periods of economic emergency and stringency. So,
mm-hmm,
so it's not. You know, it's not out of the question that something like that would occur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would hope that it wouldn't, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to ask you to share a hopeful vision with me, having to do with communities being able to wake up and learn. And if you could visualize and articulate what a community would look like if they were really waking up to this in terms of how they took on the social aspect, the educational aspect. You said in your book how you felt it's hard to imagine a more purposeless activity than American high school in our time. And we're looking at all this, one could call it untapped social capital or creativity or human power or whatever you want. Can you imagine a scenario, and can you articulate it for our listeners, of at least how some communities might wake up in time, and what would that look like in your ideal vision?
Well, I would have to start by saying it ain't going to be utopia, mm-hmm. but I think that some places will do better than other places, and it will probably depend on the, you know, the quality of the community and the quality of their leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that agriculture will come back much more to the center of American life,
mm-hmm.
and the activities associated with it will. You know, there may be quite a few benefits for us in the return of social relations that we haven't seen in a long time in this country.
Mm.
For example, the idea of people working physically together at something that has meaning for them.
Mm.
You know, of working shoulder to shoulder with their neighbors.
Yeah.
Of really getting to know their neighbors and really being mutually interdependent with each other,
mm-hmm.
and doing things for each other rather than just being isolated, you know, in that pod of darkness in front of the blue light of the television by yourself,
right.
which is where most of America has been for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there will probably be a lot of surprises. You know, I imagine that we'll have a lot less canned entertainment to divert us,
mm-hmm.
You know, to soothe away the boredom of the contemporary consumer society.
Mm-hmm.
And that implies that we will probably be doing a lot more with each other, spending more time with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be solving problems together. We will be rebuilding a value system that is meaningful. We're going to have to replace the Las Vegas mentality that America now has, that it's possible to get something for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to replace that with a value system that's more meaningful, you know, a value system based on honest efforts and earnest enterprise,
mm-hmm.
Rather than just, you know, striking it rich or getting lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the kinds of things that I think await us in the long emergency.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that many of those things you suggest are actually a breath of fresh air, are very good, getting back to some social relatedness, some connectedness to place and the land and what makes life really happen.
Yeah, I think that there is a very good chance that this experience will rehumanize us in a way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we just don't take into account at all are the diminishing returns of technology, not just the inconveniences and the, you know, the blowback of technology,
mm-hmm.
but the sheer dehumanizing quality of it, and the fact that it takes us away from each other so much. You know, every cars are very interesting, marvelous machines,
mm-hmm.
but a free full of angry people sitting in traffic is not such a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, as far as the society goes, you know, it's not very good for society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think we stand to benefit quite a bit from stepping back for a while, taking a time out from the high-tech extravaganza that we've been enjoying or not enjoying necessarily. You know, mm-hmm. another thing that I think is probably self-evident is that, you know, for all of its vaunted attraction, the suburban American dream way of life seems to produce more anxiety and depression than any other way of life in the world,
mm-hmm.
short of being in an Iraqi prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have more depressed and anxious people in this country than any other society I know of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the isolation and alienation of life spent in traffic and life spent in front of the blue light of the television,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Alone,
mm.
and the fact that our civic connections have been devastated by the suburban experience and,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and even family life. You know, the ability to even keep a family together has been devastated by the blandishments of contemporary life. So
that's right.
I think we have quite a bit to benefit from,
mm-hmm.
in a return to things that we haven't done in a long time in this country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the last couple of minutes, I would like to just give you an opportunity to say anything that you'd like to our listeners about these times coming up, and offer any hope and advice that you might like to do.
Well, I think that the period that I have called the long emergency is going to require a lot of us. You know, the time of the great American period of leisure and comfort will be coming to an end, and we're going to have to make sacrifices, and we're going to have to work very hard in ways that we haven't before, you know, not just sitting in front of a video terminal.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to help each other a lot more, be available, be sympathetic, be less self-involved. We're probably going to have to develop a different spiritual relationship with the places that we live in and the other people in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not proposing necessarily, you know, a born-again experience, because that doesn't happen to be something that I'm part of.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I do imagine that people will be returning to some sort of organized religious practice of some kind,
mm-hmm.
If only to, you know, to provide them with a an armature for organizing their lives,
mm-hmm.
Emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm 56 years old. I've outlived Babe Ruth and Mozart and Warren Zevon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel a lot of gratitude for having been alive at all in this amazing world. You know,
mm-hmm.
the philosopher Wittgenstein said, "It's astonishing that anything exists." And it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wish us all good luck in the long emergency, and I hope to come along for the ride and see how we make out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Jim. We've been speaking with James Howard Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. And, Jim, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as we go a little further down the road in our experiments.
Well, I'll be happy to come back, and thank you very much for having me on your program.
All right. Wonderful. Good day.
Bye-bye, John and Michael.
Thank you. So there you have it. James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. Whether you agree with him or disagree with him, he gives us a lot to think about, a lot of things that we tend not to think about, especially the results of our collective actions, especially in the age of declining fossil fuel supplies. We are not living in a sustainable way. So I personally believe in more hopeful visions than I think he often portrays. But sometimes it takes someone ringing the alarm and shouting and saying, "Hey, you got to do something differently," for everyone to wake up and actually get about it. The fact that we might end up in a better place doesn't mean that the alarm doesn't have to be sounded. I believe that our community can do a lot with alternative energies, with local production food, and getting back into local economies in a variety of different ways, more self-reliance, talking to each other and dialoguing about how we can do this together. Old folks, young folks, folks in government, folks in schools, ordinary citizens, folks in community agencies, we have an opportunity to work together with local businesses to create something that really is sustainable, kind of maybe the way we used to do it, with some new twists using latest generation technology, renewable energies, and so forth. So let's get together and let's start talking about it.